here to read for us. Peter Wild has been an instructor here since 1971, and one of his early books, I'm not sure it was his first, indicated not only that he was gifted as a writer, but that he was also prophetic. It was titled Wild's Magical Book of Cranial Effusions. And looking at the body of his work leads one to understand how incredibly effusive and profusive he has been. He's really a challengingly productive writer. Not only has he published over 50 books and chapbooks, including poetry, criticism, biography, and nonfiction, he's also recently edited an important historical reader of literature from the Southwest called The Desert Reader, that's out from the University of Utah Press. And he also put together two important collections, The Pioneer Conservationists of Western America and those of Eastern America. Please welcome Peter Wild.
Thank you, Allison. Glad you all could come tonight. Strangely, you mentioned my production, and the first poem is called Unwanted Pregnancies. Out on the ranch, we provided our own entertainments, like graduate students in history, loving their subjects, but worried about their careers. Meanwhile, each morning, Clarissa bore the steaming loaves of bread high above her head from the kitchen, an overweight drum majorette giving the signal for her band to play. I'd put on my spurs and chaps, then stand for hours out on the back porch, worried that those bare peaks were about to writhe and prance, that we'd become so friendly with the animals that next time, turning biblical, they'd begin to speak, telling us about what we hadn't seen. Once in an emergency, my one opportunity to be heroic and shine, just before I rode off, the opera played. For 3 seconds, a Luftwaffe of trainer bras snapping through the whole sky before me, an event to remember through my whole lifetime. Well, now that we had fun, we can get to work. my last poetry reading somewhere else went very well, but it ended up in a disaster, and I guess I've been depressed ever since. Young lady came up to me and, you know, was very polite and said how much she enjoyed the reading. And I said, I'm glad she could come. And then she said, I really enjoyed the stories you told. In fact, she said, I enjoyed them more than I enjoyed your poems. And I'm sure she didn't mean to be cruel, but it wasn't the right thing to say. In any case, I'll try to go easy on my stories tonight. This one's called Lazarus. And in thinking about this, as you all know, Lazarus was a man Christ raised from the dead. It seemed to me there was not too much to say about him. So I tried to link Lazarus to something possibly familiar to you in your own reading experience. And I hope maybe you can guess who the sort of American parallel of Lazarus might be. Called Lazarus. It didn't matter that his dog was dead, that his old wife still scowled in her grave, that his loved house had sunk into its pit. Driven through that short span of noon, while he slept, the day had shifted. And now, how could he tell them about all that up there on the mountain with the jolly Theonomous bowlers, the roaring of the balls, the ambrosial drink. After where he'd been, he went from door to door, but through the cracks they all shook their heads. And that night, looking forward to where he'd been a stranger to bedrooms, he slept out in the fields with the foxes. Beneath that one light, the globose eye of his dead brother, kept aloft by a little dog barking off in his corner, excited that it was God once again floating over this doomed but magic world. Well, I guess time to lighten up. Real fun subject. Next is Columbus. Columbus. Flaying hides or about to stab their victims in the chest. One day they all stopped at the Grand Éclaircissement. The minty light in their heads, and in that blink of cleared sinuses, they all saw Columbus putting on his shoes in Madrid. Thereafter, there were centuries of darkness, but now and then a shaman said he'd caught him shaving, or a fat woman screamed that he was having intercourse with Botticelli's mistress. So rumors flew, excitement ran back and forth across the continent, as of a grand lottery worth millions that they'd all win, until there were dozens of reports that he was even now walking across the Atlantic, happily shooting his arrows into the air, and mad with luck, nearly tipping the earth, they all ran to the same shore where they stood, a holy mob facing east. And there he was, Christ-like in his cameo of rippling rainbows coming toward them, one finger raised to his lips, promising to tell them his secret. And all at once, he was in their midst. They were kissing him, stroking the glinting feathers of his trailing headdress. And he, still not speaking, but smiling like a god, reached out with one wooden hand to touch their long, sleek hair as they shivered, while with the other handing them his gift, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Well, while we're on religion, this one's called Why Popes Don't Write Books. I guess I'm envious of popes. Everybody applauds, you know, tens of thousands wherever they go. But it struck me curious that, as far as I know, although I'm not a student of the subject, they don't write books very often. I have no idea why. And so this poem is just a sort of happy meditation on that. It's also connected to, and this, I was talking to someone's class yesterday, nobody believes me, but I have a lot of flying imagery in my poetry. There's nothing Freudian about it. When I was younger, I used to fly airplanes, and not for very long, and it was a grandly abortive career, I assure you, but there's some imagery here. Chandelles and Immelmann turns are simply various maneuvers you'd make with an airplane. Why popes don't write books. They are their own girlfriends, and thus they see so clearly they don't need money. For them, history, like all children, is what needs to happen. Sometimes when they lie in bed after a busy day, their only conflict, they don't know whether savoring their coming dreams is a sin or if they simply should enjoy what they're presently thinking. Sometimes, when no one is looking, all by themselves they sneak away, and revving up their engines, fly around in their little planes, arms folded across their chests, make them slide and dip, doing chandelles, Immelmann turns, so that the people on the ground look up and point and say, "I wonder what that crazy guy is doing." That's why they don't write books. I heard on the radio that there's a series, I don't know on what station, I guess it's public TV station, on coming up on the Depression. Am I right? Yeah. Is that going to be soon? Does anyone know? Oh, it's already, the first one's already playing. Well, I'm not old enough to have grown up in the Depression, but my parents you can't remember it, and perhaps your parents or grandparents can. And this is a little elaboration on a story that I vaguely remember being told in my childhood. It's called the Polish Baker. My father said that during the Depression, the Polish baker always made sure everyone had bread on the table. And so after work, after he'd stood with his dour wife for 12 hours taking the money in, though he didn't speak English, he'd stand in his yarmulke out on his rickety back porch, calling out in a loud voice until the hungry neighbors, waiting all day for this, but this time hungry for his music, came running across the fields, unashamed to take from his hands the crusty loaves from a barrel of them, so full it was never wasted, but kept filling itself. Elijah lying down with the beautiful daughter of the sorrowing widow, bringing her almost nubile child, babbling with the pleasures of what she'd seen back to life again. And we, their children, after the wars, the dances, become so rich we begin giving ourselves away, out of hand to the cousining poor, as if on vacation, ladling out soup, handing out sneakers to Lewis and Clark. Unlike him, so frightened of ourselves, we're generous to others. Oh, and now four or five short, but poems in a project which is problematic. They're all about fairly well-known people, figures from history. And the problem is, of course, Americans tend not to care too much about history. So, gee, what do? Footnote these poems. For example, the first one's about Thomas Jefferson. And most of you vaguely know that he was one of the presidents of the United States, and perhaps not too much more. So I don't want to leave other people behind. But on the other hand, I was thinking about this. It's sort of the, in my mind, I hope, maybe I'm just making excuses, that there's something like listening to songs in a language you don't understand, and that even though you don't know the particulars of what's going on, nonetheless, those songs can be beautiful in themselves to you. I'll say a couple things about the Thomas Jefferson poem. Of course, as with all my poems, they're meant to be uproariously funny. It's important to understand that Jefferson was a farmer, a gentleman farmer, and looked on the country, the future of the country, as consisting of small farmers, you know, good citizen farmers, upright people, etc. So he really promoted agriculture. And the first part of the poem depends on a real event. He went to Italy, where they had a particularly fine kind of rice, and they wouldn't allow it to be grown anywhere else, but Thomas Jefferson smuggled it out of the country and distributed it to other people. Also, there's a reference to his buying of the Louisiana Purchase, a good chunk of the Western United States, and his introduction to the Chinese fast food to the country. So now that you're armed, here's Thomas Jefferson. It wasn't marijuana you wore in your hair, but Italian rice, as you breezed past the liveried guards to give to your friends, those gentlemen farmers with right hearts who would make the whole country a plain, raving, so acrylic green, what a girl sees after her first sex, that she bounces from toe to toe, unable to stand a new prospect. But the truth is, like Apollo, you thought yourself already rich, free to do whatever the Constitution didn't expressly forbid, or even then hedged. You introduced Chinese fast food to a gleeful nation. You did the Louisiana Purchase, denying to yourself, always effervescent, that a secret sin on earth might be an open scandal in heaven. Even more difficult one is Aldo Leopold. We have any deep ecologists here, maybe? a marvelous man, died in 48, 49, but he defined a great many of the issues in conservation today. And one of them is currently popular and I think unfortunately misunderstood, and because it's not understood in the context in which it was stated. And that is simply in the San County Almanac, Leopold suggests that a thing that human beings do is right if it doesn't disturb nature, but as it tends to disturb nature, then we shouldn't be doing it. You know, and nature comes first, in other words. Well, that sounds very good, but it seems to me there's a real problem here, because everything you do, if you mow the lawn or drive to work, you're somehow disturbing nature. So how do you handle that in the poem? Well, factually from his life is this. His father did own a furniture factory in Burlington, Iowa. And Leopold himself became a forester. In fact, he worked here in northern Arizona for a while. So there's some play with the furniture industry and the marvels of wood. The unfactual part of it is the crazy relative in the attic, which I think you'll see what she stands for, relevant to his ideas about nature. Well, after that overly long and confusing introduction, here's Aldo Leopold. A wonderful, wonderful man, by the way. And after that, just so you can see what's coming, the next one is my favorite woman in history, Fanny Appleton. First Aldo. At my father's furniture factory, I learned about how things fit together, about roll-top desks, where the businessmen raved with the joy of making money that had the beauty of a Wurlitzer in the grain. About home economy, tables where the families gathered tracing night after night the saints, the sad musicians wandering in their wilderness, pausing now and then to look out, almost to speak to them their revelations from their prisons. Was there someone the shame of a relative locked in the attic, for years howling and thumping her chains up there when company came? Once, to be fair, we let her out, and as she rampaged through the living room, breaking things, tearing down curtains, we sat bemused, listening to what we thought was wisdom, then locked her up again. I understand that in the past, unfortunately, that when families had offspring with mental problems, that they actually were locked in attics and cellars and things like that. Pretty horrible existence. Fanny Appleton. We were the best of our ancestors, finely high-minded without harshness, and both so refined to live with that treasure each day was more than I could bear. He could, after all, have had 100 hands and kept them all going, a blithe sorcerer's apprentice. I did what I could for us. I had the glory of our children. I sat as he worked, sealing up small packets of our two younger daughters' hair. And finally, overcome with pleasure, taking flame from all that, fell into his beating arms, feeling in that moment the slight pain of passing him, becoming heir. One of the great love affairs in American literature. Fanny Appleton was the wife of Longfellow. Okay, a little different pace, and then we'll get away from these famous men and women and have fun again. This is Peter Paul Rubens, the artist, and the most recent Smithsonian Magazine has an article about him. Otherwise, I knew almost nothing about him, but so I don't pretend to any great knowledge. But the interesting thing was when he was 53, he married a young lady who was 16. And apparently had a wonderful marriage, and he put her, as many great painters do, compliment their wives or mistresses or whatever, and he put her in many of his paintings, and she has a wonderfully glowing flesh to her. And also, truthfully, in his older years, 53 was, of course, quite old in those days, several centuries back, he developed some physical problem with his hands, and every time he put his brush to the canvas, it pained him terribly. Rubens. Rubens became the first painter in history to collect his own work, hanging it beside that of other geniuses, Raphael and Titian. Not because he was 53 and his bride 16, but because it was, frankly, exactly the kind of world he wanted that, to his surprise, had come out of him. And even then, toward the last, when all he had before him was a hand so crippled, so twisted that every touch of the brush to the canvas brought him pain, he used the paint so lightly that in shock we see that her flesh still is luminous. Okay. Hoover Dam, poem about dentists. And there's another poem a little later on about teeth, too, I guess. I'm like everybody else. I don't like going to the dentists. But how do you get from dentists to Hoover Dam? That's the problem. Hoover Dam. My dentist pats me on the shoulder and tells me even his teeth ache today. His wife's a docent at our world-famous wildlife museum, and now he tells me she's announced, after all their plans, she wants to have a baby. Still, I tell him, once again shaking hands, that by living a cautious life, it's possible to come through unscathed. Still, once again, he's made my teeth beautiful enough for you. But what are all those things all around me in the sky when that night, abandoning my bicycle, lost again, I try to make my way through rich neighborhoods to your house where, on the other side, you wait in your peasant dress beside the shrine you've made to your favorite weatherman? All around, the dark houses squat supercilious behind their hedges, while above me, for one instant, from horizon to horizon, but taking their time, float rusted water tanks, strawberry ice cream cones, and irate cowboys, wise members of their own tribe. Once more, after your good meal of fish and greens, I come back instructed about what I've always been up to, finding my way through that same neighborhood by opening my mouth, wherever I pointed, using my teeth as a flashlight. That newly converted tourist, first seeing Hoover Dam at night, lighted by the power of the river that runs through it. Okay. After that, we need to get religious again. The book of Proverbs. Some of you know that's a book in the Old Testament, I guess they say written by King Solomon, and it's a series of what? Wise statements about life. Yeah. Well, in this poem, the book of Proverbs is that, but maybe it's something else too. The book of Proverbs. I know what beauty is and can almost imagine what it is to walk in a beautiful body, to sleep high in a farmhouse in Delaware, like a snowbank in a painting, like the book of Proverbs. while men who saw you today on the streets of Philadelphia are dreaming of you. Will a snowbank come alive and amazing the artist run crazy around his painting like a figure in a cartoon so fast he leaves his eyebrows behind? The Book of Proverbs just lies there, sufficient in its wisdom, daring someone to pick it up. Once your boyfriend, the bass player, coming home late and drunk from New York, crawled up the slate roof and to entertain you hung upside down in your window, tongue out, eyes wide, an insane moon, you almost shot him. One does not toy with beauty any more than one fools with wisdom. So, in your bathrobe, you peer down at me coming up into the yellow light at the top. After a year, still your perfect lover, that timid scholar who often gets lost in the books that amaze him. Another poem that deals with, well, at least one artist, Matisse. I don't remember his dates, and spanned the century, I guess, the turn of the century. And also a musician in this one is Ravel. And this poem, of course, passes on true information about these guys. Matisse used to play the violin between paintings, trying to forget the women. Blobs of ink come to visit, settled into his chairs, his bouquets, children about to run away after carnivals. It did as much good as the farmer does all day thinking about how much milk his cows can give before milking them again. The divine liqueur processed through the earth's labyrinths before it drips through his fingers from heaven. Or over there, a box of sky dropped down into an armchair where the open case lies, sunlight on the satin that held the violin, Sunday light falling on a city of intellects, on a city of Quakers who all day walked through the streets giving it praise. Is this all too easy, pleasing the middle class, wanting to rise above itself but afraid to make mistakes? Art as the ambitious universe? That's what his friend Ravel thought might be when, disappointed, he came over to muse on such things, who at 18 wrote the most famous piece he'd ever write, and thereafter, doing penance, carried it on his face, one whole cheek turned into a slab of light. What was that famous piece Ravel wrote? I can almost sing it for you. The Bolero. He did write at 18 and downhill after that. So there's a lot of poets out there. Save it for later. Oh, another tooth poem. Yeah. I hope I'm not too fixated on teeth and things like that, but don't you feel your teeth have a life of their own? You feel them moving around in there sometimes, and sometimes they're happy and sometimes they're not, and you have no control over it whatsoever? No, you don't? Well, you do. Okay, I feel better. So I thought I'd help out other people who have this sort of strange awareness as I do. And I wrote a poem to help them called Your Teeth, An Owner's Guide. And after you hear this, you won't have to worry about this problem anymore. Your teeth, an owner's guide. They sit around in your most comfortable furniture. Relatives from North Dakota you've never seen before, who years ago yelled, "Surprise!" when you opened the door, and immediately ransacked the kitchen, went right for the beer and the crackers, then made themselves perfectly at home, as if they knew about how you lived all along. Sometimes, when you're away at the office, or out front for relief raking the yard. You can hear them in there, sophomores always partying, turning up the television, throwing their old cheese sandwiches around, dismantling everything you've worked for. And at night, in your aguish sleep, loving themselves only, they're still at it, once again lustily singing what they think is a new song. Our greatest goal in life is not to be happy, but to glorify God. Well, a more serious and instructive note, we're very fortunate just down the street here, what is it, Second Street, to have the Historical Society. If you haven't been there, I hope you find time to drop by and just wander through their displays. And of course, they have important research projects, and I've really found a very fine bunch of people. And as I've traveled around, I try to make contact with local historical societies wherever they are, and it's incredible. Some of the smallest little burgs, like Darby, Montana, they have one room in the drugstore devoted to history. And that's all very fine, and such people have been very kind and helped me with my own researches. But I started thinking, why are people doing this? You know? Maybe to pass the time of day, and maybe out of curiosity. I'm sure there's a variety of motives. But maybe I'm getting cynical in my old age. I think that most of us do things for some reason that we're doing it for ourselves in one way or another, which is okay. This Studebaker is over there on Second Street, in case you want to see it. Beautiful old car. Local historical societies. Wherever you are, history was taking place. A forest felled by a strong wind while an Indian gawked, seeing God's hand in it. Or a wedding where people cheered for that moment the bride and groom thought themselves extraordinary. That's why we put on displays the sheriff's 1933 Studebaker riddled with machine gun bullets, the humble scrap of shoe leather lighted in its case, the gasp of the dying messenger bringing good news to the besieged. That's why we volunteer and put up with each other, hold fairs, dinners, rescuing ourselves by rescuing others. Oh, okay. I'm not going to say anything about this one. You'll get it. We'll have a quiz afterwards. It's called Daniel. Remember Daniel? Okay. You bet I was hungry, but sat in my den, a monument to myself, all night drugged, fixating on my mental epistaxis. The tiny angels, all named Wendy, pirouetting on the tip of my nose. Seeing him come floating down, such a quiet believer, a pair of pajamas just out of the washer without a man in them. Watching him as the globigerina ooze of the night surrounded us, standing there glowing all night long. And when morning came and the crazed king called out, go floating back up, right past my nose, smelling glorious like bread, fresh from the oven. Poor lion. Since it's almost a winter's day, many of you are from back east, or at least have been back there, know what it's like, and you know that in the springtime, the crocuses come out, right? And when the snowbanks melt back, oftentimes the crocuses are right there in the moist soil and they grow and they're very pretty yellow. I think they're purple sometime, right? And we have similar flowers here. In fact, I think in the Rockies, they're called snow flowers and they follow the snowbanks as the snowbanks melt. sign of spring. And this, there's no reason to mention this, but this, and in any case, is the same woman as in the book of Proverbs. I have no idea what the ending means. It just seems right. That's a poor excuse. The last time I visited, you came running down the stairs and pointed to a dirty pile of snow under the pines at the end of your drive with, of course, its choir boys of crocuses coming up. We saved them just for you, you said, shivering in your house dress. Days we romped in the woods, jumping brooks, past farms, clear into the next county. That time of year they didn't know which way they were going. I've been thinking of you too much, of how the Portuguese nearly ruined China by introducing corn. Sleep is the stage for our dreams. Nights we drop by for short visits to see what's been going on with those happy players who go on for hours, whose whole life is the theater. Well, we don't want to end on a somber note. I'm wearing the subject of this last poem. It's my pants, see how they fit? Feel good? Smoke jumpers pants. You know, smoke jumpers are these crazy people in Montana, Idaho, and they jump out of planes, parachute, of course, and then fight fires. And well, I will tell a little story about this one. For many years, I had a friend up in Montana who owned a ranch in the middle of a wilderness. There were no roads for many, many miles, no electricity. It was just wonderful by right on the shore at the side of a wonderful trout river. And I'd go up there every year and hike in or ride a horse in or sometimes even fly in and land in his pasture. In any case, there were two young ladies there who I'd known perhaps better than I should have. And one year I arrived, hiked in 20 miles or whatever, and they greeted me at the door and they said, oh, you know, nice seeing you again. They said, we have a present for you. And they went back in the kitchen. They came out with this pair of pants, which I'm now wearing. And they said, I hope they fit. And I put them on. They did. And I said, where did you get these pants? And they said, well, the other day we were out walking around looking for bears. That's a pastime. What else can you do in the wilderness? Look for bears. And they came upon this pair of pants. True story. And they assumed that it must have belonged to some smoke jumper who left his pants behind, I guess. Well, I just couldn't leave that one alone. So this is the story of how the smoke jumper's pants got there. All of us are looking for love. And so a week before the guests arrive, the cook and her helper, having everything right in the kitchen, walk out across the river, their brains held together with bandanas, supposedly to look for bears, but really to decide what the summer will bring. There may be lions in the trees, thistles that when the sun hits them just right make the amateur photographer famous, even verbena, diminutive ice cream that they shout at underfoot, leaping back from the mound of the old homesteader's cabin just as they expected. So two women can fall in love with their futures when out together and the day is perfect, throwing their arms around each other and hyperfibrillating when they see the meteorological event of the year, a pair of starched pants falling from the sky with no man in them. Because looking down into the blossoming fire beneath him At the last minute, he decided this was not the sort of business he wanted to jump into today. And solely on the strength of his best wish, soared back up into his plane, while they, amazed, rushed up to see where they are now, falling through the trees, one leg crumpling, and then the next, settling with a sigh by the time they arrive, to read the label that says that the one who cares least runs the relationship. Thank you for coming tonight.